This is September 23rd, 2007, and this will be, this Teisha will be a continuation of what we started last week, which is a discussion about faith and doubt, period. And last week we focused on Mother Teresa's crisis of faith. We read from an article about a Time magazine article, recent Time magazine article about, that's a month ago now, about this, about her spiritual darkness, even to call it a crisis of faith. It was a 50-year crisis of faith where the article, the Time magazine article, is reports on a new book where in which the author presents the private notes, even just dashed off notes to herself and to her confessors, to other her peers and her superiors, about her great doubts about Jesus and God. I have to avoid getting too much into this, repeating too much, because we have so much more material. But what struck me about this whole story was, and in fact, about the tension between faith and doubt in all of us, you could say, was how much it reflects another basic dichotomy, which is lightness and darkness. And that got me remembering the title of a book that I started years ago and never got very far in for one reason or another. And so I plunged back into that book and read it over this past week, actually last night, and the book is called "The Light Inside the Dark," and the subtitle is "Zen, Soul, and the Spiritual Life." It's by John Tarrant Roshi, who is a teacher in the Diamond Sangha, or formerly in the Diamond Sangha, whom I worked with about 10 years ago, something like that. We got together went over a lot of koans and compared our notes and our perspectives on, the book is the most remarkable and original presentation of the spiritual journey that I've read by any contemporary teacher. Well, let me read. This will be the quick way. I'm just going to pick out one of the blurbs on the back of the dust jacket. This is by Jack Kornfield. "An exquisite book which carries your deepest longings and loves with the lyrical voice of a nightingale. This is one of the best guides yet to the breaking open of the human heart to vulnerability, eternal spirit, and the mountains dancing." What is really remarkable about this book is not just the language, which is really deeply evocative, but the grasp of the ups and downs of spiritual practice, and presented as this great arc of the interplay of faith and doubt, and ascent and descent. And what I'd like to do is with using this book, introduce a vocabulary which I find very useful, very insightful, and I hope that others who hear this will as well. And that's the vocabulary of spirit and soul. And by spirit and soul, it's not used in the way that you may think. But without trying to describe it, I will just read some passages from here. I just made peace with the fact that because his writing is so complete, I'm just going to have to read some paragraphs as they are, because I think it's better than any attempt I can make to summarize it. Just a little summarizing, so that we can just get some traction here. Spirit and soul roughly correspond to the absolute and the relative, terms that many of you have heard many times and worked with, the spirit being more of the emptiness or formlessness side, and soul being more the form, light and dark, spirit ascending to spirit and descending into soul. Spirit is you could say energy, and soul is matter. Spirit is mind, the soul is our body, our emotions, our feelings. Spirit is the ideal, the eternal, God, heaven, perfection, virtue, whereas soul is the real, the human, the earth, the world of time and change, the world of imperfections, flaws, vices, failure. Spirit is success. Spirit is purity, clarity, cleanliness, silence. Soul is the real world of mess and noise and disorder, the passions, greed, craving, hostility, confusion. Now I'll read. He starts off talking about spirit. Part of spirit's weakness is that it is so clear about its goals and so reckless and headlong in their pursuit. It's a goal like enlightenment. Okay, I'm going to get enlightenment. That's spirit at work. He says that Mr. Bugatti, the founder of the automobile company that bore his name, was asked why his racing cars had poor brakes. He said, "I make them to go, not stop." And this is very like the spirit's point of view, thoroughgoing, full of absolutes. Adept at transcendence, spirit gives us the foundation for understanding reality, but is of little help with the day-to-day arts of relishing life. As in those Renaissance paintings that show just the feet of Jesus as he disappears out the top of the picture, spirit wants only to ascend, to be pure. Always getting by with less so that it can encompass more, spirit forgets to feed the kids or hold a job. It lacks poetry, melancholy, and everything voluptuous. These it leaves to others, as if it needed servants to do its living for it. I'll do some just stream of consciousness associations here. Always getting by with less so that it can encompass more. Spirit is behind the impulse to fast, to do with less, to get rid of, to give away, to pare down, to streamline, to focus. And now soul. To enter the realm of spirit, to enter the realm of spirit then is only a part of the solution to the dilemma proposed by this process of life. The remaining art resides in living well, in the particulars of our movement through the day and night. And this means attending to the second impulse of inner life, being interested in the feet of God, the parts that are still visible and have not ascended out of the picture. These toes and callous skin are the neglected element of the divine, the bit that touches the earth, the bit we have. This second impulse, simultaneous with and contradictory to the first, takes us toward the little and the disregarded, the valley world that is lovely, seductive, transient, destructive of our illusions and also of our wisdom, not the life eternal, but the life that we die of. Even full of loss, even full of disease, this aspect of existence too is good. It has its point of view and its disciplines. It does not replace, but intermingles with the spirit. This is important because the last thing anyone should misunderstand is that these two are somehow ultimately two. They're not. This is a vocabulary. It's a way of understanding these conflicting forces, all too usually conflicting forces in us, and so that we can get our arms around both of them and become whole. That's the point of all this. But like any concepts, spirit and soul and ascent and descent are very limited. They're not the real thing. They're just ideas. This lower part is bound on the wheel of time. It loves the sound of rain and the smell of basil. It stands at the foot of the bed, feeling the heart enlarge before the face of the sleeping child. It is the servant who tends to life, who tastes and touches life, who is life. More on soul. In love with the multitudinous world, soul is pagan. It falls headlong into matter. Scattering its affections, it likes to merge with chocolate, gardening, a fast car, a lost love. And while it brings delight, it brings misery too, joining with rage, jealousy, and vanity. Where spirit is certain of its path, soul, like Dante in the dark wood, is always losing its way. It obsesses and broods. Like Proust, it is drawn back and back into a childhood still vivid and full of causes. It is with our souls that we truly inhabit our lives, tasting the fresh black coffee, so delicious, so bad for us, and the kiss, so brief and full of consequences. Soul is always learning, always fallible. It develops well or ill. It grows and deepens in response to our late learned tenderness toward it. Through soul, we bless our lives and come to love them in all their moods and aspects. Soul is weak because it loves, which is, of course, its strength. Soul is creative. It produces something invisible out of matter. All love is the love of God, it declares, and plunges into the first kiss, into a glass of Shiraz, into saving the planet, into eating a bowl of steamed clams, into remodeling the kitchen. Soul connects and loses itself in the connection. It falls and falls. It falls into beauty. Soul loves to include and to learn. It is always trying to embrace things, to inhabit the brokenness of the world. Its light is made real by the surrounding dark, its bounty earned by the perilous journey. Soul does not abolish the difficulty of our lives, but brings a music to our pains. Its gift is to make us less perfect and more whole. One of the reasons I'm taking the time to elaborate on this vocabulary of spirit and soul is because I think it's fair to say that as a broad generalization, that those of us in Zen tend to be strong in spirit and less so in soul. Maybe it's because of the promise of enlightenment as the ultimate, the eternal, that which is beyond all categories. We yearn for this realm that is this realm of freedom, where one is not bound by form or words or emotions or time or imperfections. We say it in the four Bodhisattvic vows, the great way of Buddha, I vow to attain. Endless blind passions, I vow to uproot. I've never known anyone who has uprooted them all perfectly. He goes on, every journey toward wholeness involves the interplay of spirit and soul. Neither is sufficient alone, for we are hybrid beings and cannot confine life to a single purpose. I imagine the conversation between spirit and soul might begin like that of so many couples, with a description of each from the other's point of view. This is more than a summary of the misunderstandings between them. Through showing the weaknesses of each view, we sidle up to a refreshed sense of their necessary virtues. This analogy of marriage, you can carry that further, and I think it's often the case that we're drawn to our partner because he or she has more of what we lack. Well, of course, that's there's no question about that, but even we can see that in terms of spirit and soul. And I think also as a generalization, men tend to be more geared toward spirit, not wanting to deal with feelings and emotions, wanting to keep everything simple and women, I don't know, I'm not a woman. Soul knows, I'm continuing to read here, soul knows that where spirit is too dominant, we are greedy for pure things, clarity, certainty, and serenity. This may seem harmless at first or even desirable, but since nothing is wholly pure, it leads us to grow heartless with the natural unkemptness of existence and to think we can make order by imposing rigid rules. This is the realm of fundamentalism, by the way, most spectacularly visible in the fundamentalist militant Muslims. Then, inevitably, a shadow grows, until all too often there is a fall into appetites swollen because so long suppressed. This is why we find scandals in the lives of so many religious figures. Spirit forgets the necessity of imperfection, and that within our very incompletion is the opening where love appears. It does not understand the essentially domestic and mortal nature of human life. Identification with the spirit, then, is not the goal of the inner work. Such identification can have disastrous consequences because it leads us to think of ourselves as right, as immune from ordinary failings. We have to care for the whole of life so that spirit does not overwhelm our modest and preserving virtues, but finds its proper place, which is central and limited. On the other hand, when I would say that in front of Roshi, sometimes he'd finish the sentence, is a wart. On the other hand, spirit knows that soul in itself does not have enough of a center. When soul is too dominant, we lose connection with the infinite source and fall under the thrall of the world. Our attention is dispersed into objects, and we struggle with the problem of our desire, which renews itself before it is completely satisfied. Soul wanders ever deeper into the marsh of emotion, looking for catharsis, the authentic story, the reason for its pain. It forgets that it can rise. This would be people who are attached to the past and to their story of suffering. If soul gives taste, touch, and habitation to the spirit, spirit's contribution is to make soul lighter, able to escape its swampy authenticity, to enjoy the world without being gravely wounded by it. Spirit knows that soul longs to be released from its addictions, its obsession with childhood, its night terrors, and to be able to say goodbye as well as hello, and with something like grace. In the light of the spirit, the tasks of life, profound and small, the labors in which soul is so engaged, from birth to dying, from sex to art, from walking in the city to eating pancakes with maple syrup, are transient. All of these labors and pleasures are transient and not to be relied on, sacred, but not to be taken too seriously. So I think that's a good overview of these two complementary opposites. And then he takes spirit and soul and applies it to the path, the journey, and the coming and going of faith and doubt, and ultimately this journey is not, it's a spiral. We ascend, that is, we often begin practice wanting to free ourselves of our attachments and focus. This is the realm of spirit. Just this, just mu, just the breath. This is the way to awakening. We have a choice always, I believe, between depth and breadth. I said this yesterday to someone at the workshop when I was asked about trying different teachings and practices. And what I said was, yeah, in the beginning, it's good to, if you feel you need to shop around, see what appeals to you, what resonates with you. But then I believe then it comes a time of focus where you need to go deep into one thing and not just spread yourself thinly. That is, if you want to reach this realm of the eternal, of ultimate peace. You don't need to. We know people who their temperament is such that they prefer to spend their lives basically trying different things and exposing themselves to more and more practices and subjects and learning and study and partners. But in doing that, we are not likely ever to get to the ultimate. And so in the beginning, it's natural for spirit to predominate. Again, just mu. But then after this ascent, and especially after we have reached the ground of being, which is the ground out of which all of these dichotomies arise. That is, once we reach this true mind, this original nature, then comes the problem of integrating our attainment, our understanding of this ultimate nature of things, integrating that into the world of soul, of imperfection, of human life. And this is the descent. And this comes from pain. The original ascent, where we first launch spiritual practice, the journey, this itself arises from pain. No one begins practice perfectly happy. If we were perfectly happy, we'd feel no need to do anything about our lives, ourselves. So even before any awakening, any attainment, there is this descent into what I experienced as a kind of reaching a density, a critical mass, where I had spent years unhappy with my life, my relationships, but not unhappy enough to do something about it. And it was then when I had a couple of crises when I was still 20 years old, that's where finally it flipped, and I just realized I have to do something. I'm sick of myself. I'm sick of my life. I'm sick of what I do to people and what I do to myself. And so that's the descent. And then, there's more here about, let me see here. Yeah. I don't want to focus strictly on practice as ascent and descent, but also as just the our evolving as human beings. And I want to go in that respect, go back to Mother Teresa, who you remember from last week, those of you who were here, she had been already practicing as a nun. She'd been a nun for something like 15 years. And before she came up with this plan of opening a mission to help the poor and the hungry, and she launched this campaign with her superiors to let her, to give her permission to do that, and it was after she finally got permission and she started this mission in 1948, that's when the darkness came. And that you can see also as the descent. She had reached success in stubbornly, doggedly pestering her superiors to let her open this mission, to found it, really. She was the founder. And they pushed back, and finally, after months, they relented. She got her way, and then things went south. There's a passage in here where he's talking about the it's under a little section called the pathologically pure. He says the clergy are poor at governing because they identify so strongly with the perfection of their vision that they leave no room for life. They attempt to bring the rigors appropriate to the early stages of a private interior discipline into the public realm. In the private realm, cutting off all distractions and extraneous interests, denying personal whims and fancies. I think here Sashin is the perfect example of this. Turning away from everything apart from one's own narrow path lead to deepened attention. In public, they lead to the Inquisition. And even in the private realm, in the long run, if we do not accommodate our little vices, they grow large and spill over to torment those close to us. This idea of the pathologically pure, you see it in political movements, in Nazism, the Khmer Rouge of Cambodia. You see it in the Taliban. We read last week that those letters I just mentioned that she was petitioning, she was using to petition her superiors to let her found her mission. Her biographer says, illustrate two linked characteristics, extreme tenacity and a profound personal bond to Christ. So she was successful. This tenacity, this determination, this focus is often brings success, but it's not complete in itself. And I'll read more here. There is always a second descent for the illustrious. So the first for her was probably what led her to the path of renunciation and become a nun. The one who had been yesterday adored is today derided. People he hardly knew and to whom his only connection had been to perform mild favors appear in print to declare that he has always mistreated them. This I just relate this to Mother Teresa in terms of the people who were disillusioned, who will be disillusioned reading about this, and she asked that these notes that comprise the book, these private notes of hers to herself and to others, be kept, they be burned after she died. The strategies by which we came to success rarely help to maintain it. And mortification teaches us that the disciplines of the inner life must continue whether we are at the heights or in the depths. And this, the great public dramas of mortification are enacted within us when we make in the inner life the same mistakes the famous make in their outer sphere. The spirit tries to find its way into the world without regard for any other factors, disregarding precisely the small, temporary, physical gestures that make life amiable. Such hubris leads to the inevitable explosion of whatever has been excluded. And often through this book, he draws from mythology to outline this this process, this journey. he uses this phrase to pay the dark, meaning to pay our dues, really, to go through darkness again and again. After awakening, then the darkness is never as dark. But he says to pay the dark is to carry the stone of our own suffering, asking for nothing. The courage with which we bear our darkness frees others from having to carry it for us. This, I think, this sentence really points to what a gift Mother Teresa has given us unintentionally through these miscellaneous notes she wrote to herself and to her confessors. I should think that a Catholic worth her salt or his salt would find inspiration from this. Well, I don't mean to, of course, to many, many people, this would be bruising to hear about her 50 years of darkness and spiritual desolation. But to see that she accomplished everything she did, even with these doubts, with this descent, where she stayed down basically for 50 years, then we can maybe stop beating up on ourselves for our own failings. I think it's a very common response to enlightenment stories to feel a little discouraged sometimes. You hear about these heroic exertions of the masters, these incredible stories of staying up without sleeping, without lying down to sleep for years, subjecting oneself to every kind of severe discipline, all in the interests of coming to awakening. And many people I've heard from, and I remember this myself in my early years, think, oh my God, if it took this much for this man to become a master, what hope is there for me? I feel so insignificant and like such a loser compared to these great heroes. But that's why hearing about the struggles, the doubts, hearing about the doubts and the confusion of the masters can be elevating for this very reason. The courage with which we bear our darkness frees others from having to carry it for us. We can read account of Mother Teresa's doubts and hopefully feel find some greater acceptance of our own doubts and our own darkness. It's not that darkness of hers was unchanging for 50 years. There was a moment, as you remember from last week's Teisho, where things did shift for her. The darkness did not disappear, unfortunately, but it became more bearable. I don't think for a minute that Mother Teresa ever had an awakening, a real enlightenment experience. Otherwise, I don't think she could have been stuck in that darkness all that time. But even if one does have an initial awakening experience, one then can later suffer more pain, of course. That's, as long as we have a body-mind, we're going to be in pain sometimes. There's a koan in the Mumonkan called the number 10, Sozan Impor Seize. A monk, Seize by name, said to Master Sozan, "I am poor and alone. I beg you, Master, to please make me rich." Sozan said, "Venerable Seize." "Yes, Master," replied Seize. Sozan said, "You have already drunk 3 cups of the finest wine of China, but still say your lips are not yet moistened. These words, I am poor and alone, this is almost verbatim what we read in the Time magazine article about Mother Teresa's confessions. She felt dry, dead, cold, alone. Venerable Seize, yes? There. You've already drunk three cups of the finest wine of China, but stay, your lips are not yet moistened. What do you lack? What is it you're looking for that you don't already have? Hakuin describes all kinds of struggles after his first awakening. Many of the masters do, where they have not even just a small awakening, a deeper awakening, and then still it may carry them along for a few months or years, but then comes the descent again, the descent back to their sense of dissatisfaction. I want to offer more admiration, respect for Mother Teresa. There's this painful incongruence between what she reported in these notes that were then now have been published and what she was doing with her life. I've had people come sometimes into Doksan during Sesshin, late in Sesshin, like the fifth or sixth day of Sesshin, and they're in a makyo where they suddenly have been assailed by self-doubt, and they think they have to leave the Sesshin. And more than one of these people has said to me, as they in their distraught condition, Doksan, they cry out, "I can't do this." Now they've been doing it for 5 or 6 days, and they're saying, "I can't do this." Mother Teresa's. There is this split, this dissonance between how she felt separated from God, from Jesus, and yet look at the work she did. If we substitute, instead of God, or Jesus, if we substitute Mu, or whatever our practice is, the breath, another koan. We can, those of us who have worked on these practices a long time know that we have to, we will be confronted by the sense of estrangement from that which we want to join with. Where Mu at times seems stale, dry, remote, dead, thin. as Jesus did to Mother Teresa. But she showed through her example exactly what one of such strong spirit does. You just persevere. We go through these periods of darkness. And how do we get out of them? We just stay with it. She felt betrayed. She even said sometimes she felt betrayed by God. And we can feel in this work, we can feel betrayed by our practice. But there are some words that comforted me in many points in my practice that I often then repeat to others. If you don't let the Dharma down, the Dharma won't let you down. You can understand why it was Mother Teresa who said these wonderful words that I've sometimes said at the end of a sesshin. She said, "We are not called to be successful, we are called to be faithful." I would consider Mother Teresa a kind of bodhisattva. John Tarrant writes here, "Bodhisattvas can be of service because they have a gap, an opening through which we meet them." A bodhisattva for new people just means, ultimately means one who postpones his or her own final enlightenment in order to be of service to others, to bring others to enlightenment. So she was wildly imperfect. But you can see how many people responded and were inspired by her work. He says, John Tarrant says, "Every step into awareness means letting go of an old way of being, and the unavoidable grief of that change is loneliness. With its special talent for mourning and delight, the soul enters us through cuts in the healthy flesh. When we are in pain, it is amazing how much tenderness we are capable of, and how much joy we can take in the happiness of others." When we hear now about her pain of all those years, it is more understandable that she would have such an empathy and such, yes, tenderness toward the poor and the starving. He goes on, "Even our anguish is one of the engines that preserves the world and makes possible our human joy. Only angels and monsters are always strong and transparent of conscience." Well, I was thinking as I was settling into the seat this morning that a teacher who gives teisho is always descending afterward into the awareness of how imperfect it is, how inadequately, and this is after every teisho practically, how inadequately words one can express these profound aspects of practice and movements, this dance, in this case, between spirit and soul, perfection and imperfection. It's like a, a dissent every time one gives a talk. Not just a teacher, I'm sure, but one has to face the flaws and the pain, the mild pain that comes from and the pain that comes from in starting in about 1 minute from now when I remember the things I forgot to say, the connections I forgot to make. All right, we'll stop now and recite the four of us. Enough about me.